government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this October the 23rd on the West Coast and October the 24th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zones. I'd also like to welcome all those who may be listening live or on an archive on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, as well as Blog Talk Radio.com. Well, before I bring tonight's guest on board, I was perusing some websites, and I happened to stop over at Kenadachi's educate-yourself.org and found a disgusting article. Disgusting in the sense, not because Ken posted it, but just the topic. It's called, When Asked Where the Constitution Authorizes Congress to Order Americans to Buy Health Insurance, Pelosi says, quote, "Are you serious?" This is dated Friday, October 23rd, and this was on CNSnews.com. The gist of this story is that this, described the question posed to the person who's being called Nazi Pelosi on many websites and on the internet. The Speaker of the House is declaring that the federal government has the right to dictate to us that we must have health insurance, and that if we opt out of health insurance, we would have to pay some sort of a fee to exonerate ourselves from that, and that because Congress controls and administrates, in a sense, interstate commerce, that gives them the right. Well, that's like saying because Congress, and you could ask Barney Frank about this, is engaged in pedophilia and abducting children and selling them into the slave industry, and because that's international or interstate commerce, that we should allow that, or that we are obliged to comply and participate in such actions. This is insane what these people are trying to do to this country. I'm not saying that people shouldn't have any kind of health care. Health care should be affordable, and it should not be a racket like war. It's been turned into a racket. It's been shifted totally in favor of the pharmaceutical companies, who have no liability for the atrocities that they commit, including the murder of their so-called customers. And this is just kowtowing again to the pharmaceutical companies, and the health industries are controlled, as we know, by companies like DynCorp, the company that was trying to take over Hardin, Montana, over this past month and a half. And actually, this has been going on for several years. It just surfaced recently. These people are insane. Psychopathic is too nice. It insults psychopaths. These people are absolutely insane. And we have to put a stop to it. We have to stand up to this insanity. Well, that said, I'm going to bring on tonight's guest. He is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher. He's our honorary science advisor here on Evident Footprints, and he's been on this show every week since its inception. And he's also my co-host on Friday nights, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hi, Don. How are you? You're off to a good start there. And as long as you brought that up,
okay,
I would like to interject 2 cents of my own.
Please do.
I don't know how observant people are in general, but have you ever noticed that when the government really, really pushes something, that's an exact giveaway to the fact that it shouldn't be allowed. Now, they're pushing this healthcare thing left and right, and they want it executed before the end of the year. What's the rush? You know, this kind of reminds me of the frantic movement to get these bailout payments made in a big hurry, and several other things that they've pushed for so vehemently, none of which bore any worthwhile fruit for the American people. It's only for those who are initiating these kind of actions that there's anything in it of a worthwhile nature. And you can bet your life that the same thing is going to happen if they get these mandatory health care programs pushed through. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, you know, you hit the nail on the head, and you asked a rhetorical question that I could answer very specifically, and that's they're being found out on every front, which is why they're so drastic. People are waking up. People are standing up to this corruption, the financial corruption, and this transcends everything. Everything they do. If you want to talk about food production, there's corruption in that. You want to talk about education, there's corruption in that. You want to talk about what they do with public funds and how they spend it on themselves, it's corruption. Everything they do is about corruption, and this is just a diversion to give us something to preoccupy our consciousness with. And instead of promoting health, and I'm not talking about healthcare, promoting health and wellness, you know, they don't make money doing that. They haven't figured a way to do that because their methods are purely destructive. And it's beyond psychopathic, I have to say. It's just pure evil insanity. And it's chaotic. They want to produce chaos throughout the world. They're the ones that are chaotic. They want to produce terror. They're the ones that are terrorized by their own demons. So I don't mean to go off on a rant, Jim, but I'm just trying to answer that rhetorical question. And you and I were going to continue on the path of consciousness, and I think this is certainly something to hang your hat on as far as making a commitment to become consciousness. When people are this insane, we've got to rise up above this. This is the lowest of the low. So I turn the mic over to you, my friend.
Well, I certainly agree with you. There's no two ways about that. And all I can say is those people are very lucky I'm not in charge. But anyhow, since I'm not, let me take command of the few things I can do.
Okay.
We left off last week, for those listeners who may not have been present, discussing various topics which in themselves don't have anything to do with the raising of consciousness, but which cannot help but broaden the scope of an individual's knowledge and his realization that the world is very different from the one that we're immersed in. And so for that reason, and that reason only, we're exploring some really unusual topics, and we were doing that actually for the past couple of weeks. I believe we left off last week discussing such interesting things as the exploits of Ivan Sanderson in Africa and Colonel Fawcett's discoveries in South America, both of which indicate the possible continuing existence of prehistoric animals. Ivan reported having been attacked by a pterodactyl in Africa while fjording a small river. And I remember that story so vividly because I was sitting there at his table with his wife, and he was relating it to me. And you could tell just by the look on his face that he was reliving it as he spoke. And he was crossing this river, and he was about chest high in the water, and this blood-curdling scream came from the trees above him to his right, and he had his rifle and his pack held over his head to keep him dry, and he looked up and saw this thing coming down at him, and it had a wingspan that must have been about 8 feet or long or wider, and a great big beak and a crested head. But he said he knew right away it couldn't have been a bird because the beak was full of teeth. And the only thing that he could think of to avoid being hurt by this thing was to submerge, which is what he did. And when he came back up again, he could see the thing gliding back up into the trees on the opposite side. And I was always struck by that. I thought that was an amazing experience, and I knew Ivan well enough to realize he had no reason to make the story up. Matter of fact, I think he related it in a couple of the books that he has written. It's a shame he's passed on. He would enjoy this the opportunity to relate this type of material directly, and Don, you'd probably enjoy having him on your show. The other incident, which was really interesting, was that Colonel Fawcett, while he was exploring the swamps in Bolivia, was said to have come across a reptilian creature, which some people believe was an Allosaurus or the descendants of an Allosaurus. And in one of his books, he's got a sketch showing the footprints of this thing crossing the mudflats on one of these swamps. And the reason that this is exciting for me is because not only do I believe that this is a possibility for a number of reasons, but the reputation and the veracity of the people who are making these statements is beyond question, in my opinion. And considering the fact that neither one of these men ever had made any kind of fortunes or relied on the public or anybody else to sustain them, and they never sought the limelight in any way other than to reveal the truth, says to me that they were simply reporting realistic incidences that they thought the rest of the world should know about. And that's exactly the reason why I would like to relate these kind of things. I think that it's important for the world to know about this kind of stuff. It shatters the confines of the normal box that we all live in and gives us an idea that the world is much bigger and much different than what we perceive in the artificial environments in which we are forced to live. Any comments on that, Don?
Well, I'm inclined to agree with what you're saying. I find it fascinating. And if you have a recommendation for a guest, certainly I would entertain, you know, anyone that you recommend, as you have in the past.
Well, I just wish that these two gentlemen were alive and with us.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they have left for the other realm.
Mm-hmm.
One related incident, which I know a little bit less about, but which is very well described in a book that was written by an associate of Ivan Sanderson's, a gentleman who I believe was Swiss, if I remember correctly. His name is Bernard Gouvernement, and he's a very intriguing guy that had been running around the world with Ivan collecting specimens and getting animals for zoos and that type of thing. And he wrote a book called On the Track of Unknown Animals. And this is a really worthwhile book if anybody wants to, you know, read about the foundations of cryptozoology. That would definitely be the book to read. But anyway, in this book, he relates a story which is pretty incredible, and it has to do with the fact that when the the czars were still in power in Russia, an expedition, a hunting expedition, was sent deep into the Taiger Forest, and I don't know what they were hunting at the time, but the interesting thing is they came across a herd of mammoths that were grazing on the tundra, and this supposedly happened in the 1800s, so it's not that long ago. And for those people who've never heard the term of the Taiger Forest, and I think that's how it's pronounced, is a very, very large tract of land in Siberia someplace that is very well forested. And the interesting thing about it is it's in a very remote area, but it's not just your little run-of-the-mill forest. This place has a territory which is something like two-thirds of that of the United States. It's an enormous tract of land, and anything could be in there. So if I had some way of doing so, I would personally go there and look for these critters because, you know, to find a vestige from our prehistoric past still living in the modern world, I think that in itself would shake people up and certainly expand consciousness. Don't you, Don?
Sure. You know, I have a question. I'm sure some listeners may be wondering. When you describe mammoths in fairly recent times, and I think you've even alluded to the fact that some of these may still be alive on a past show, I think last week when we talked about this a little bit, is there a place where this is officially documented somewhere, you know, and how would one go about looking for information on that? Can you recommend a source of information, or did you just hear this through the grapevine?
No, this is the story related in Bernard's book.
Oh, okay.
On the track of all unknown animals. But well, just to let you know, I have done some searching on the internet to see if there's any information concerning, you know, surviving mammoths. And interestingly enough, there are two articles which anybody should probably be able to find, which are really worthwhile. One of them has to do with pygmy mammoths that were surviving up until a very recent time on the Aleutian on one of the Aleutian Islands off the coast of Alaska, and the other pertains to not necessarily a mammoth but some form of mastodon, which was seen very recently, and I'm talking about within the last, I don't know, let's say 5 years. But that was in an area near Nepal in northern India. And I forget what river system that these people were exploring, but they went in there on elephants, on standard elephants, and actually managed to get photographs and movies of this this critter, which practically dwarfed an elephant. I mean, this thing was absolutely monstrous. And there was a special about it on TV. Unfortunately, it wasn't, you know, very well publicized, and it was one of those things that after they aired it, you never see it again, which is unfortunate. But very, very interesting show. And, you know, this ties in with hundreds of different things that have been seen around the world, Don. It's not just a question of mammoths or pterodactyls. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff floating around. And we just don't hear about it because, there again, we rely on the media to bring us stories like this, and quite frankly, they don't report anything that's not in their favor to release.
When you mentioned the reptilian earlier, I was thinking of the bipedal kind. I was going to ask, you said it may have been an Allosaurus. Wondering if that's any relation to George Soros. But
oh, very, very interesting. Well, I don't know enough about vertebrate paleontology, you know, to give you a concise answer. But one thing is probably quite reliable to state, and that is that they're both carnivorous.
That's true. Well, I got a little political jab in of sorts anyway. It wouldn't have worked if I used his real name, Georgi Schwartz. So.
Oh, I don't know his real name.
That is his birth name, anyway. Why these people have to change their name, I don't know. But
they like to remain incognito for some reason.
Yeah. When you said reptilian, actually I was recalling something I read in one of T. Lobsang Rampa's books some years ago, 30 years ago or so, actually more than 30, probably 35 years ago. He had made a prediction that we would start finding beings anywhere from, I think he said, 12 to 20 feet tall in pristine condition in the ice, say, around Antarctica. And I don't know if that's happened or not yet. Of course, if it did, we wouldn't hear about it, at least not without a leak occurring. You reminded me of that, so I had to go down that trail for a moment.
No, that's quite all right. Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, you know, there was, I think it was the same guy, Lobsang Rampa, that wrote another book called The Cave of the Ancients.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's another thing that's supposed to surface somewhere around this time period. And, you know, we've heard stories from people like Edgar Cayce about the fact that there are some repositories of ancient knowledge still left on Earth. One of them is supposed to be in a room underneath the Sphinx, and another one is supposed to be somewhere either in the Yucatan or in South America. And I guess there was the original one was supposed to be in Atlantis. But anyway, you know, these tablets or these gold plates that have the entire story of the true nature of mankind and his origins. And the pity of it is that nothing could be more vital to find and publicize than that type of information. And you can bet your bottom dollar that if the establishment ever heard about such a discovery, that the knowledge would never ever be made public, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just something that they would never never condone. But
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to make a general comment. It seems that they always have to ridicule the person or persons that bring this astounding information forward, as if somehow us knowing about this is going to be harmful to something. Well, it's harmful to their game is what it is. And certainly they've lied to us throughout history. They've lied. Everything has been based on lies and deceit. And for the truth to come out and to have people start paying attention to it and realize that we are something other than what we've been taught we are, it really threatens the game, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the interesting thing is there was a point in time, probably not that long ago either, when it was pretty common knowledge that our ancestry was not as normal history, you know, portrays it. There were groups of people, if nothing else, that certainly knew about the fact that mankind had a different kind of history. But even then, a lot of this stuff was it wasn't suppressed in the normal sense like it is today, but it was sequestered within the confines of special groups. And that's unfortunate in a sense, because the fact that these small groups had this information and kept it to themselves for various purposes still prevents the general public from getting it. So it's just a difficult subject all the way around. But the interesting thing is a lot of information about this type of stuff survives. Now, one of the things that's intrigued me, Don, over the years there are many, many stories with copious information attached, I might add, that suggest visitations from other planets to the Earth in times gone by. And, you know, one of the most interesting ones, of course, appears in the Bible. Now, I don't know how other people view this, but the story of Ezekiel and the experience that he had always struck me as a human being trying to describe a mechanical device that was completely beyond his comprehension. And I believe
you mean like a flying saucer, right?
Yeah, or okay. Some kind of a vehicle, right?
Yeah.
I believe that's what Ezekiel experienced, but it doesn't matter what I believe. If you really want to hear about it from an authority, there's a fascinating book called The Spaceships of Ezekiel. It's probably out of print now, but I have a copy of it. And it was actually written by an aeronautical engineer from NASA. And he was a guy who, he was a perfect example of somebody who started off poo-hooing the idea that there could ever be such a visitation and in such an ancient period. And not only that, but to have it recorded in what is considered to be a holy book. And yet, when he started reading it with that in mind, and he went out of his way after he got hooked on this to get the most accurate translations of some of the words that were used so that he could really figure out what they were talking about. And as a result of going through all this research, he drew up an image. An engineering drawing, essentially, of what this vehicle looked like, and published it in the book, and it's pretty amazing. I mean, it's a very, very peculiar but very interesting form of vehicle, and there's no reason why such a thing couldn't be built. But it was a combination of a rocket of some sort, probably nuclear. And four helicopters. And, not only did it have, you know, helicopters, blades on these landing pods, for atmospheric flight, but the interesting thing was that, they also had robot arms, for handling, isotopes perhaps, or moving cargo around and stuff like that. And the most striking thing, though, was the wheels within wheels, which the so many people make such a big deal out of. I remember reading an article one time in the Watchtower about wheels within wheels, and it was so convoluted that it was, you know, beyond human interpretation. But when this guy, who was an engineer, read the description in the Bible, he realized that what it was a very unusual design of a wheel, which not only would roll in the direction in which the wheel was pointed, but which could also slide sideways against the direction of travel on an independent set of rollers if it encountered, like, a crosswind or, you know, if it had... maybe it had a landing velocity that wasn't quite, you know, straight in the direction of the craft's movement. And he was so excited about the possibility of a double-acting wheel that he actually designed one and got a patent on it. And this came as a result of reading the encounter of Ezekiel from a scientific eye, instead of from a religious point of view. And that's only one tale. I mean, there are literally thousands of them. Another one that's really very, very interesting is there's a church, a little chapel in Czechoslovakia, which I believe is a Serbian, it's either Serbian or Greek Orthodox church. And It has a huge mural painted on the wall behind the altar that depicts an aerial dogfight between two flying machines, and it clearly demonstrates the presence of a pilot in each machine and fireballs flying between the two devices. And awestruck people on the ground watching this encounter and fleeing from the scene in terror. And there's no written explanation, you know, but it's very obvious that whoever painted it is trying to depict something real that happened. And there's no effort made by the artist to disguise the flying machines as something spiritual. They're machines, and they may not understand the exact nature of the machines, but you know, they've got guys sitting in seats holding controls and great white light coming from the back of the entity, and fireballs flying out of the front end of it. And so, you know, we're forced to believe, or at least I am, that this was inspired by something. I mean, you know, it's not usual that a normal human being decides to depict something totally outside his experience just for the heck of it. So the human mind doesn't seem to work that way. So more likely it's a depiction of something that was actually witnessed, you know, 1,000 or so years ago in this remote part of the world.
And well, I think it would have been much more. Wouldn't it have been maybe 2,500 years ago or more?
I'm not sure of the... we don't know the actual time that the event occurred, but the history of the church is pretty well known. And mm-hmm. it certainly didn't predate Christ. So, you know, it's fairly recent in the calendar of things. But we don't know when the actual event occurred.
But yeah, I'm just basing that statement on the fact that the book of Ezekiel was thought to have been written in the 500s B.C., so,
but that was a whole different event. This is something that happened in fairly modern times, apparently.
Oh, okay. I'm inclined to just comment for a moment on the book that you referenced, the Spaceships of Ezekiel and Josef Blumreich or Blumreich. In German, the fact that he wrote that in 1974, why are we still waiting for disclosure if he was accurate in his assumption that Ezekiel did have some contact or have a vision of astronauts and a shuttlecraft from another planet, then certainly they're admitting that there's life outside of the Earth. So why are we waiting for disclosure?
Well, it's the same old story, you know. I mean, just because somebody wrote that and did it with a description from the Bible doesn't seem to convince very many people that there's any substance to it. It was just, you know, most people say, oh, yeah, well, some egghead from the Aeronautics Administration decided to interpret the Bible his way, you know. And...
Mm-hmm.
You know, until something lands, you know, right on the White House lawn in front of, you know, every major television camera, you know, like in that movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, I doubt very much if people are going to get the message, you know. I think they're just too steeped in the program to grasp the fact that there's no way that we're alone in this universe.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just underscoring the fact that they acknowledge the book, they credit a NASA engineer, for his insights, and yet at the same time, we're told none of this is real. You know, I'm just making a point here. It's not intended to be any deeper than it is on the surface. So.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a very easy brush off to just say that he read the story of Ezekiel and got an inspiration and drew a craft as a result of that. That doesn't mean it really happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get the point.
But I believe it probably did. Anyhow, yeah. Moving on, we have this other interesting thing that there's this tribe in Africa, and you'll forgive me because a lot of times I've read this stuff so long ago, I don't remember all of the fine points, but there's this tribe in Africa I believe they're called the Dogon, D-U-G-G-O-N.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
They report a very fascinating situation where they were visited by a people that they call the Dropa. And mm-hmm. the Dropa supposedly came from the twin star system of Sirius. And the interesting thing is, in their tribal heritage, they have so much astronomical information concerning the double star system that we have only, you know, discovered again in recent times. Like, for instance, the fact that there's a dark twin star in the Sirius system, and they know that what the orbital frequency is, and all kinds of stuff that there's no way that some remote tribe in Africa should know any of that information. And the interesting thing is, they were just living their own lives, cherishing this experience amongst themselves. It wasn't like they were broadcasting it to the world, so this only came to light when these people were interrogated by modern man. And here they have information that's been in their tribal system for hundreds or maybe even thousands of years. I have no clue. And it turns out to be scientifically accurate. You know, so there's another amazing incident where, you know, there's obviously something that happened that's beyond the scope of normal explanation. And yet you don't hear anything about it, you know, unless you really go and look for it. So I find that pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's always the same story.
It's the same story in the sense that, you know, thousands of different reports suggest that we've been visited. And many, many times, and probably by more than one culture.
Well, we have millions of reports that we're being visited right now. So it really doesn't matter what's happened in the past. The fact that it is happening right now is rather significant, I would say.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. It's very significant. But I'm just trying to point out the fact that if it happened in the past, it's even more extraordinary because at least nowadays with the space program and all the things that are going on in terms of our own technology, people can at least grasp that, you know.
Yeah.
And say, well, you know, now we understand all this kind of stuff to a point. But when you go back that far in history and you have similar things happening, the people of that time certainly didn't possess the necessary scientific foundation to appreciate what they were seeing. And mm-hmm. yet they recorded it anyway.
Yeah. Well, the irony, too, Jim, is that we accept this technology as a reality, yet somehow we can't conceive that there would be people elsewhere that would have already developed this technology thousands of years ago and have much more advanced technology than we do. You know, and that whenever anyone addresses this issue, the way to handle it is to mock them. You know, it's asinine how basic the mind control is. And, you know, we're beyond that. We're contemplating the methods used to to accomplish interstellar travel the way it's done by these groups. And the very idea that we're alone in the universe is reminiscent of their fear of us knowing the truth about anything, really.
Well, you're right.
Well, thank
you. And
you know
what else is interesting too? You don't have to address such complex issues as space travel in order to see anomalous situations in history. I mean, if you look at Peru, if you look at Mexico, if you look at Central America, if you look at Egypt, and forget the monuments and all the engineering feats, what's not talked about a great deal are the medical accomplishments of those times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have found skulls that not only show that brain surgery was performed on people, but the fact that the bone regrew is a direct indication of the fact that the patient survived and went on to live we don't know if it was a normal life, but he certainly went on living long enough for the incisions to mend, even in the bone. And, you know, there were definitely abdominal surgeries performed. There's quite an incredible medical papyrus that was found in Egypt that covers this entire subject. And, you know, the depth of knowledge that they had about medicine is scary. And you know who did an awful lot to uncover this was a guy by the name of Schwalla de Lubitz. And he spent most of his life studying the more arcane aspects, or hermetic aspects might be a better term, of the Egyptian culture. And it's all very well and good, you know, to say that they just had a remarkable degree of technology when it came to building things and a beautiful system of art and whatnot, all of which is true, of course. But to neglect the other accomplishments that they had is really tragic. I mean, this stuff should be brought out, you know, in an official capacity. But of course, for the same reason as we discussed earlier, that isn't done. But if you want to read a fascinating book that delves into this in great detail, not only does it talk about the medical prowess that they had in Egypt and combines it with a knowledge of the solar system and the construction of monuments and what have you, but goes into the philosophy behind all of this and why it was done and how it was learned. You should read this book called The Temple of Man, which is written by this guy, Schwalla de Lubitz. And, you know, he talks about the fact that some of the temples were actually built deliberately as analogs to the way in which the human brain functions, and the hidden meanings in a lot of these different things. And mm-hmm. It's amazing that this guy could uncover this kind of stuff. It took him his whole life of study, you know, in a very obtuse direction when you consider how different his thinking was from, let's say, standard Egyptology,
mm-hmm.
To come up with all this. So,
Jim, I don't mean to interrupt you. Hold on to that thought. We have a caller. Would you like to take a question?
Sure, always.
Okay. We have Ron in Pennsylvania calling in. Ron, welcome to Evident Footprints. How are you?
Okay, I'm doing okay. How are you guys doing?
Oh, very well. Thank you.
Okay, I wanted to pick up with something that I couldn't call in last week on a Friday. I don't remember what the situation was. It might tie into what you're talking about tonight. When the author Ivan Sanderson was mentioned, I think your guest, Jim, I guess, couldn't remember the title of the one book. The title was Invisible Residence, which I have. and it tied into something of what you guys are discussing tonight. But ask your opinion on something. There was a discussion on Antarctica, and I happen to have been sent a copy of a restored map that was made by the Germans who were down there in 38 and 39, and they mapped out that whole continent right to the T. Now, people think Antarctica is an island. It's not. It's a continent. It's a landmass. It's locked into the Earth. Now, the map is extremely detailed with all the warm water lakes, mesas, areas, sounds, hills, valleys, and so forth. Now, that was before, actually, right at the start of the war. Now, if they did that, there was also rumored dotted lines to show where a base is suspected to have been built. Now, with that in mind, they apparently had the wherewithal and the equipment and supplies to get down there by submarine. And they must have had contingency plans to go back down there if something didn't work out or if it did at some later time. Now, that means they had enough of food to take with them down and back, or they had the ability to grow it down there. And at the end of the war, it was rumored that supposedly Hitler escaped by submarine, which we really don't know to this day. There's never been any definitive, finite answer on that. Now, if they were going to go back down there, they were going to go back down for a reason other than to escape, and if Bill's base was down there, they were going to stay for a while. Now, how they built any kind of a base back in those days without equipment, I don't know. But at the end of the war, there's 1,100 or 1,600 tons of patent papers were stolen by the United States, just taken. There's a treatment on that called the Great Patent Heist. And in German, I think it's the Great Patentraub or something like that. But I used to work for a certain company with a very good friend of mine, of whom I'm waiting for an email. He was a design engineer, and he was down in Antarctica for a couple of years, and I never really asked him that much about that. Now, expeditions from various countries have been down to Antarctica for decades working down there. In fact, about 20-some years ago, or a little bit better, there was an ad in our Pittsburgh Press paper, which is now defunct, advertising for a craneman to go down to Antarctica to work for a year or two. Well, I wasn't able to pick up on that employment, although I'm skilled in certain areas like that. And what would you need a crane for in Antarctica unless you're going to put up some buildings that are heavy or sections of them? You don't need big buildings and a lot of them to study ice and snow and penguins. I think there is something down there, or there's a potential for something down there, because various countries have teams of engineers and biologists, they say, down there staying and working for some time. So, then this is, 60 years ago. I have to wonder what is down there, what was down there, and why they are down there even until today.
Ron, let me make a quick comment, and I want to give Jim the opportunity to respond to what you're saying. And regarding last week, by the way, I was not made aware that you were on hold. I had a chat message waiting for me, and I presume you just gave the message and left. So anyway, we know that the Germans had flying saucer technology. There are pictures on my website of the German saucers, especially the Vril models. So they didn't have to go there in submarines. We know that they used submarines to transport gold, but they likely used these ships as well. They certainly had anti-gravity. Now, I'm not saying that they had anti-matter. Most of the craft that we're talking about were made for flying within our atmosphere. And you can tell by the gun turrets on various levels, on top and underneath these craft. I've been accused of posting pictures from movies, and so I've countered by saying, okay, that sounds fair. Tell me what movie this is from. Of course, they couldn't do that. They're genuine pictures. So regarding Hitler, we know Hitler was here in the United States. We know he lived at Lake McDonald Lodge for 30 years and traveled about the country doing MK Ultra projects with Joseph Mengele. who goes by the name of Stephen Rabel. So I respond to that comment about Hitler and the submarine with that. But I want to give Jim a chance to comment, too.
Well, the thing that I find interesting about this gentleman's remark is the fact that he's absolutely right. You know, a lot of this international interest in South in Antarctica seemed to establish itself back in, I think it was 1958, during the International Geophysical Year. And all kinds of people went down there, and ever since, a lot of countries have maintained bases and research activities there. Now, the question about why are they going there and what's down there? Well, if we go back to what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago with the story of Admiral Byrd,
yeah.
He started his exploration at the North Pole, but then in an attempt to follow through on what he discovered at the North Pole, he also repeated those activities at the South Pole. And accordingly, he was claiming that he found an area down there about 1,500 miles in, across that was totally ice-free, and he had identified it as the opening to Agartha. And the interesting thing is that if that's true, and of course I don't know if it's true or not, but I do remember seeing articles, even in National Geographic, back in the 50s, the late 50s, or early 60s, that showed totally ice-free areas. And of course the original explanation was given that it was probably volcanic activity that kept the area clear of ice, but then there were no volcanoes depicted. So it's difficult to say. But the interesting thing is that if there's any truth to that, and it is one of the main entrances to Agartha, considering what Agartha is supposed to be, I can't imagine what nation on earth wouldn't want to know more about that. But it's just interesting that if that's the case, here's a perfect example of how every government on the planet that had the money to do so went and set up a base in Antarctica to study something. And not one iota of information has reached the public about what it is that they're doing down there. So it's just another example of how governments look upon themselves as an elite group, and the peons aren't allowed to know anything.
Yeah. Well, does
yeah,
that...
Go
ahead, Ron.
Okay. A friend of mine, he started his career probably in the 50s, and I started mine in the 60s, so he's 10 years older. And in the old days, not like today, the engineers and other certain discipline crafts, you could float around quite a bit, and this is how you acquired your experience, and that's one reason he was down there. And he's really good at what he does. But currently, right now, he is in another state taking care of his mother. She's in her mid-90s, and she's blind and deaf. And he's getting up in age himself, and he has not responded yet to my email. I'm going to communicate with his wife up here, who's in another city. So I'm going to attempt to find out more about, and this is some years ago, that he was down there and what he was doing. And why the current interest for decades and decades down there just to study ice and snow and looking to see if your flowers can grow by the lake, I don't buy that.
Yeah, they were developing new tents. They were testing them out.
Yeah, who's also funding all this stuff all these years other than governments? Somebody's putting up the money in each of these countries for this.
Well, you'd have to consider it's probably the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and
I'm thinking.
You know, the Illuminati families.
Well, I have other maps and stuff like that, and I'll conclude with that I'm going to try to get a hold of him and get more information, and maybe if I can scan the maps, I can throw some stuff your way.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, let us know if you do find anything out. We'll be happy to share that information with the listening audience.
Yeah, it was called New Schwabenland. If you recognize the word, have you ever heard that term?
Yeah, Neuschwabenland, yes.
Yeah, new.
Yeah,
well,
it's a popular Irish name.
I'm going to do some digging. Take
well,
care.
Ron, I would also invite you to come back on the show and tell us what you discover if your friend responds to your inquiries. Has he gone?
I think we lost him there. Yeah.
Well, hopefully he heard me anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he'll listen to the archive again, I'm sure. And just in case you're listening, Ron, make sure you let us know what you find out. And we'll be happy to share that with the listeners. Yeah, it's always interesting. I guess Ron was trying to phone that information in a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about that. And didn't know he was on hold. So that happens sometimes. You know, regarding this issue of, you know, what happened to Hitler, if you follow the history books, he committed suicide. If you go into what has come out from all the investigative journalism that's been written, not to mention what Otto Skorzeny himself said, and I base much of what I responded to Ron's comments with on that information. I did quite a bit of research and found that Skorzeny was telling the truth. Virtually about everything that he disclosed, he was telling the truth. And, you know, it's going to be hard for a lot of listeners to accept the fact that Hitler died in the United States and in the year 2004. The powers that be were very quick to dispel the rumor that the world's oldest man at age 114 had died in Seat Pleasant, Maryland, at the Clinton nursing home, this man didn't have any proof of his birth, so therefore he was 92. Now, how do you make such a conclusion? And they used a genealogy expert, I think, from UCLA, if I remember correctly. Don't remember the gentleman's name, but they had to get a specialist to determine how old the man was, who he had no information on whatsoever. And that in and of itself is quite a story. I've got a lot of research, and I should probably write something up in that regard because it ties into some of the things that Ron said and even you, Jim, on many occasions.
Well, you know, to live to be 114 and still be functional tells me that the guy didn't just have a healthy set of genes or good DNA. More than likely, he had access to alchemical assistance because that was something that was very, very pronounced prior to World War II in Germany, was the secret pursuit of the knowledge of alchemy. As a matter of fact, one of my dearest friends who lives in New York happened to be another fan and another investigator of the works of Wilhelm Reich. And he had that information, which I never was privileged to get a hold of directly. And he got it from the person that's in charge of the Wilhelm Reich infant trusts or something. I forget the name of it. But anyway, it's essentially an organization that Reich set up in which most of his unpublished documents are residing. And they're supposed to be released to the public, you know, sometime in this century. But anyway, what he gleaned from talking to the curator of this collection was the fact that even Reich was involved in alchemy. And that's where he got the understanding of the orgone energy and how some of his earlier work was involved in studying the chemical nature of dew. And, you know, anybody that's ever read anything on alchemy should be aware of the fact that people who were practicing it at the time used dew in their experiments, not just tap water. And they used to take these pure cotton and linen sheets and suspend them on stakes above the ground. And then they would go out in the morning at certain times of the year when the dew was most prevalent, and they would take these sheets off of the little stakes that they had driven in the ground and wring them out into special containers. And they would save that water, and that would be some of the water that they used in their earlier experiments. Now, that's because of the fact that the orgone energy, the life energy, the chi, whatever you choose to call it, is apparently resident in great quantities in the dew at certain times of the year. And these people knew this. And so, you know, this whole thing goes back to the idea that, you know, there is a separate reality. There is a separate set of information that is available to certain people. And those people seem to use that information for themselves rather than for the general good of mankind. Now, how Reich got a hold of that, I couldn't tell you. But because of the fact that he tried to disclose all of his teachings and his and the things that he learned to the general public, well, what happened to him? First of all, he was arrested on a technicality. He was put in jail. He was blamed for being a supporter of child pornography and prepubescent sex and all this other nonsense because of the fact that he was trying to explain that there's nothing wrong with the natural sexual urge and that it it can manifest in children, and the fact that it is suppressed usually in anger and violence contributes to the neurotic attitude of most adults in our society. And all of the things that he was trying to disclose cost him his life. The interesting thing is that cellmates that were in the same prison that that Reich was put into, and I don't remember what prison that was, by the way, but the interesting thing was when they were later interviewed, they said it was common knowledge in the entire prison system that Reich was going to be wasted. And of course he was. He was murdered in jail. The public was told he had a heart attack. But this is what happens when people try to release the truth. And if it gets too close to home, then something strange happens to you.
Yeah, they have. We have similar situations going on today all over the place, be it in microbiology or sophisticated advanced weapons, such as the case of Michael Reconosciuto. It's how they operate, and it's another example of the deceit and the lies and the organized crime. That's all it is. They have to silence their critics. They have to silence those that bring forth the truth because they feel at a disadvantage if others know what's really going on. And it's a pity because they see themselves as God, and yet they have so many weaknesses. And that is what Dr. Christopher Holmes describes as their psychopathy. The illusions of grandeur and the fear that they exhibit simultaneously. They're oxymorons of themselves. So, no pun intended, by the way.
Well, you can just drop the oxy part and I'll be very happy. But
that's what I meant.
The interesting thing too is though, you know, the cold hard fact of the matter is, I don't care how wealthy they are, or how elite they think they are, they're all cowards, every one of them. I mean, I at least some of the mafia figures and some of the criminals that we've had in our society that had the tenacity to do what they did openly, you know, they can merit a little bit of admiration because they had the nerve to come right out and disclose who they were and what they were trying to prove or what they were trying to do. But these people can't do that. They all operate behind the scenes, it's all cloak and dagger type stuff, and you know, they don't have the nerve, you know, to come out and disclose their goals or their objectives openly. I always thought, to be honest with you, that if a presidential candidate got up in front of the various states in which he was running for his candidacy, and actually got out there and said, you know, folks, if you elect me, I'm going to rob you blind. I'm going to lie to you from morning till night. I'll steal everything that isn't nailed down. And if anybody disagrees with me, I'll either have them jailed or murdered. I think he'd get elected. I think he'd get elected for telling the truth.
Well, yeah, he probably would, because people would say, oh, he's just kidding. He's just joking. You know, it's that.
Well, after that, they might actually believe him and say, hey, here's an honest guy.
Yeah, well, we sort of have that situation right now, don't we? Except that he's not admitted a thing. It's quite transparent, though. And I'm speaking about the New Guinea long-legged Mac Daddy.
Oh, I knew who you were speaking about. That was pretty obvious.
That is his new name, by the way.
Yeah, by the way, as long as you brought that up, have you read this latest thing where they actually discovered the fact that he admitted when he was running for senator that he was born in Kenya?
Indonesia, actually.
Well, there was two arguments. One said Kenya, one said Indonesia. But the fact of the matter is, he personally admitted, and apparently they got articles quoting him that he was not a U.S. citizen, because he even was challenged on that issue by somebody, and Obama's response was, well, it doesn't matter. I'm not running for president.
Mm-hmm. Well, the very paper that reported very recently, you know, when this whole certificate of live birth controversy came up, they presented bogus birth announcements from the Honolulu Advertiser, and which is the newspaper it was supposedly published in. It was as phony as a Federal Reserve note, and there was an admission by a candidate, political candidate, that she was from Thailand and Obama was from Indonesia. This is actually printed in the paper back in January 8th of 2006. And then the following week, they made a correction to that statement. They didn't want that out. Now, you would think that the paper claiming to have published the original birth announcement would have realized that they had claimed that Obama was born in Honolulu. That's the nature of the lie, you see, because they hadn't created the lie totally, publicly, because it hadn't surfaced in 2006. That's not when it had come out. So it was changed at a later date to hide that, but they knew that they had the intention of putting him in office back in 2006. That's quite apparent, and that's the issue. And they also knew he wasn't an American, which is why they made the correction. But there was really no reference to the birth issue after that, just that they mistakenly reported that he was born in Indonesia. Well, it wasn't their reporting that did that. It was the interview and what the interviewee said that they had published, you see. So, you know, we have this controversy still going on, but it's interesting now that Indonesia comes out after what I've disclosed in the Three Stooges Go to Washington. It's rather uncanny that that's coming out now.
Well, it might be uncanny, but it's about time, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the truth has to come out, and it always does.
I hope so.
And that's the essence of what we've been talking about for the last year, you and I, on this show, is getting to the truth. Whether you know,
there's so many facets to the truth. You know, it's amazing because no matter where you turn, everything is shielded by a construct of illusion and lies. And if we could only tear down those illusions, you know, everything would look new and fresh and pristine because you'd have a vista 360 degrees around of totally new points of view, totally different knowledge, and an atmosphere of hope for the future. You know, if these lunatics get their way, there is no hope for anything. You know, they want to enslave the planet. They want one great big celestial plantation here. They don't want any kind of individual contributions. They don't want independent thinking. They just want obedient meatbags who don't give them any problems and work themselves to death within the confines of the system. That's all they want.
Mm-hmm. Well, our vegetarian listeners might take offense to the fact that they might be considered meat bags. You could say meat bags and vegetables. But you're right, Jim. I agree with you that it goes way beyond anything that we could consider as sanity. And certainly these characters that view themselves, view themselves as gods, just don't get the picture. They really don't get the picture. And they're oblivious to any consequences for their actions.
Well, that's obvious.
So, you know, it's like the proverbial hamster wheel, isn't it? Only sometimes I get the feeling I'm watching them in the wheel, you know?
Well, you know, the thing that is amazing to me, I can't imagine that these so-called elite don't have a member of their own troop somewhere, sometime, that revs up and says, you know what, I don't care so much about how we've got things organized, but I don't want to spend my life being a manager of this. If we know about these extraterrestrials and super sciences and incredible medicines and extinct animals that are still existing, whatever other things they may know about, how is it possible with all that wealth that there isn't at least one or two of these individuals that says, you know, the norm for me is not going to be managing the herd. I want to go off and explore all this stuff and see what the real world is like. I don't want to be part of the illusion. Now, you know what occurred to me, and this would be something for you to comment on, maybe, just maybe, that was the kind of individual that Michael Rockefeller was. Because what was he doing, you know, down in New Guinea? That was certainly not, you know, the normal grooming for an elite offspring to be down there pursuing his own interests, you know.
Yeah, well, he allegedly had an anthropological degree from Harvard, or anthropology degree, if you want to call it that, and he was... He was studying, you know, the spin was that he was studying these primitive tribes. What I think was he was there to facilitate both the illegal drug smuggling that the Rockefellers have been involved in throughout history, and, you know, because of his his knowledge of anthropology, it would make him a wise or an experienced individual to acquire different types of artwork and artifacts from all these different societies he was interested in. It certainly plays into what's going on today, because by all accounts, it appears that they're bent on destroying the whole ecosystem of the planet, and let's say roughly 6.2 billion people that they want to eliminate to get down to their manageable 500 million. So they're looking at ending the creation of all these things. And it's sort of sick in a way, if you think about it, that they would have this lust to have all the relics from humanity in the process of destroying it. You know, it's insane.
That's not any sicker than a serial killer who collects toes or ears or nipples or, you know, other portions of his victim. It's the same type of sickness on a larger scale, that's all.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the role that Michael Rockefeller played was not the role that they portrayed when they faked his death, and I'm convinced they faked his death. There's no doubt about it. The story didn't make sense, and their documentation of it was as phony as a Federal Reserve note. Again, we have a benchmark of comparison here. They were collecting these artifacts for the Peabody Museum, which is a joint venture between Yale, Skull and Bones, and Harvard. And I can tell you, again, my research into the Federal Reserve showed that the founder of the Loeb Classic Library, James Loeb, was a Nazi born in Germany, and that they outright lied about him being from New York. Why would an American tell an INS official at Ellis Island that he was born in Germany, unless he was? And I was never challenged on my article either. In fact, it's been proven to be true. So we know that these prestigious Ivy League universities like Harvard and Yale band together to amass these fortunes by going out, you know, around the world to these people that are willing to accept an axe for a valuable piece of artwork that could probably feed the whole tribe if they were given its true value in some form or another, food or wealth of some kind, a medium of exchange. What did Rockefeller do? He gave them 10 axes and a couple of knives so that they can continue to carve wood. His being there, I think, had much more to do with how the family runs the business, across the globe. And it had nothing to do with his personal interest. You may be right, as far as your comments, but that's my take on it. And I spent a lot of time, down that rabbit hole, so to speak. Well, Jim, we're about out of time. I want to give you an opportunity, to make a closing comment. I'm certain we'll be continuing this discussion again next week.
Well, we certainly can, Don. I mean, to be honest with you, I haven't even scratched the surface on the collection of interesting anecdotes and scientific anomalies that we could look into. I just don't want people to lose track of the fact that the reason that we're talking about this stuff is because of the fact that, it prompts people to think and to open their minds to other possibilities rather than the standard explanations for everything. And I think that's important. So that's the reason why we took this detour and the reason why we'll continue it, at least for another week anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked about the mastodons in Siberia. and we ended up with Michael Rockefeller in Indonesia. So there, I guess we connected the dots somehow in between.
Well, actually, that's a very true statement when you stop to think of it, because actually all the dots are connected. They're already connected. It's up to us to notice the connections.
Yes.
And, you know, that's the interesting thing about reality.
Well,
there are many realities.
Yeah, you pointed out that these are illusions, and you talked about breaking down these illusions, and I think we don't even need to break them down, really. All we have to do is recognize that they're illusions and stop believing in them and create something. Create what it is that we would choose for ourselves. Because I certainly don't like the choices that they're making for us, and they're not really making the best choices for themselves. You know, when you think about eternity, the rewards that they're facing for what they've done on this planet alone are going to be something for them to contemplate for the rest of eternity. There's no doubt about that. These people are they're going to be found in a garage sale, you know, somewhere in the universe. So, Jim, I want to thank you for your I can't believe I said that. I want to thank you for your contribution to tonight's show, and I look forward to your next appearance on Evident Footprints next week.
Well, I'll be happy to make another contribution. It's always a pleasure to work with you, Don.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com, Wind Talkers Radio Network, and on BlogTalkRadio.com. Special thanks to tonight's guest, our resident science advisor and my co-host on Friday nights, Jim Murray. Also, we'd like to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me again next week, starting Monday night, for another great show. And in the meantime, I want to wish you a night filled with peace, love, and light. And have a good night.